Now, before I ask you whether you have questions from last session, I'd like to plot a table I started drawing yesterday, but didn't quite finish it. I think I have enough room here. So there it is. So the contents that we were talking about, possible contents of the universe, of course, they could be more complicated, but simplest ones are radiation or relativistic matter, dust, all non-relativistic matter, vacuum, oh sorry, curvature, and the last one is vacuum. Okay. So the things, the columns that we were going to fill out here were W, the equation of a state, how A scales. What else did we have? Gross? Rho, yes, rho, perfect. OK, let's put rho here first, then A. And I'm going to put, I can add a few, I don't know, it may actually get a bit boring, but I can add other things like Q, the deceleration parameter that I introduced yesterday. Or I can add, what else? Conformal time. Now, this conformal time, Hirani has asked me to derive this for you, so I guess I'm obliged to do it just for next week. But then other things, we don't have to go through them all. So, okay, so help me remember what it is. So W for radiation is? 1/3. For dust is? 0. For curvature? -1/3. And for vacuum? -1. Good. So everybody's awake. That's good. So, now the densities, now remember, we had this energy momentum continuity, or we had a matter continuity equation, which is basically rho dot plus 3h times 1 plus w times rho equals 0. Now, remember where this came from. This came from energy, this comes from the first law of thermodynamics, basically, in expanding universe, but you could also derive it from energy momentum conservation. So either this, so there are really two. There is a simplistic picture for this. So imagine a box that's expanding, and this is essentially dE plus pdV equals 0 if rho is energy density, so E divided by V, and P is pressure. So these are essentially the same. Or you could derive it here. Now, you would think that this is just a classical equation. But I mean, the fact is that locally, you can use Newtonian in classical physics because the rho is a local quantity. It's locally defined. It's local density. So is pressure. So this equation is really equivalent to this at least to the zero component of this equation. So you can get it from either from here or from here. Now, the point I wanted to make was that this doesn't need to be the whole density of the universe. It could be the density of any component in the universe, as long as it doesn't talk to anything else. So imagine that you have a box, and you have different particles in it. Let's say you have photons, and you have hydrogen atoms, basically. Assuming that they don't talk to each other, you can write this equation for each of them individually. So you have one equation, essentially, if I is the name of the species, you have one equation for photons, and you have one equation for hydrogen atom, for example. So you have basically two equations if you have two species. Any species, any component of the universe that's decoupled from other things, doesn't talk to other things, its energy is individually conserved. That exactly, you're right. This equation is true for any individual component, and it also is true for the universe as a whole. So for sum of energy, sum of pressure. And it's not surprising because the linear equation, remember the original form of this, is what rho I dot plus Gh rho I plus Pr plus zero. If you have several components, you can just add all of them and you get the total density and total pressure. So this is not too surprising. Now the interesting corollary of this is that this implies, or this one implies, that rho I, if you remember, goes as a to the power minus 3 times 1 plus wi, right? Where w is what appears here. And this is true independent of what else you have in the universe. So, for example, your universe could be dominated by matter, but you still have some leftover radiation, and its density would still scale like this, as long as the radiation doesn't talk to matter. It's decoupled from matter. So, okay. So I just, this is something that I think interesting fact. This doesn't have to be all the matter. It could be any component. Okay. So now trying the trivia game again. So radiation, how does it scale with A? Anybody remember? 8 to the minus 4. How about dust? 3. Good. Curvature? 2. And vacuum? Doesn't. Okay, so it's constant. Because it's vacuum, so it doesn't change. Nothing is always nothing, so it doesn't. Now, the curvature could have either sign. It's not really a content, as I said. It's just a component. It's just a term in Einstein, or sorry, in Friedmann equation. So one way that people keep track of all this is defining the so-called omega variables, which essentially is the fraction of matter in either of these. So if you remember, Friedmann equation looked like this. So you have rho, then minus k over a squared. So you can define this guy as being some energy density. It's not real energy density, but say some effective energy density associated with curvature. So you can call this guy basically something like h pi g over 3 rho k. Okay? Now, what people, so there are two definitions that are very, very useful and used in cosmology. There is rho critical, which is essentially the density, if you measure the Hubble, if you believe in Friedmann equation, so if you believe Einstein gravity, if you believe in Friedmann equation, it means that if you measure Hubble constant, it tells you how much density there is in the universe up to this curvature correction. So it tells you what is h pi g over 3 times rho plus rho k. So that density is called the critical density of the universe. And this is something that if you can just measure it based on kinematics. If you measure how fast galaxies are moving away from you, that gives you the Hubble constant. That defines the critical density for you. Now, historically, it was important because, and well, you could say it still is that if the density of matter in the universe is equal to the critical density, it means that rho k is zero. Yes? Why?
You have this equality when, to define the critical density, it's nowadays.
This is definition of critical density at any time. So, if you have Hubble constant is anything, rho critical is 3h squared, 3 Hubble constant squared divided by 5. So this is the definition of critical density. Maybe you think of a different definition. At least this is the definition I'm kind of used to. Although there might be other ones I assume. Now, the thing is that if rho matter, so this is everything other than curvature, is equal to rho critical, that means that rho curvature must be zero. If it's larger than rho critical, so let's see. I mean, this is an easy enough thing to say to see. If rho matter is larger than rho critical, means that, well, you can go back here. So this is, by this definition, is just 8 pi g rho critical over 3. So if rho is larger than rho critical, that means that k must be positive. That means that you have a closed universe. If it's equal to rho critical, it means k is equal to 0. It means you have a flat universe. And you remember, this is the spatial hypersurface that we discussed in the first session, or maybe second session, a couple of days ago. This means that if you have a closed universe, it means that the spatial hypersurface, the constant density hypersurfaces in the space-time are spheres. If k equal to 0, they are flat planes. And if rho matter is less than rho critical, it means that k is less than 0, means that you have an open universe. So your spatial hypersurfaces are hyperboloids, right? OK, so I mean, these are kind of obvious. But it's interesting that essentially all you need to know to geometry, all you need to know in order to find out the geometry of the spatial hypersurfaces in a homogeneous universe is to measure the Hubble constant and measure the matter density. If you can measure the average matter density, and then you compare it with the rho critical that you get from the Hubble constant, this comparison tells you essentially, well, the naive thing to say is that essentially tells you the topology of the universe. That's not quite true, but at least in this simplified picture, that seems to be the case. That if it's bigger, your universe is spherical, or your space is spherical. If it's less, your space is hyperbolic, is open. OK. You look very puzzled. This is essentially rho critical. This is rho matter, this is rho k. Rho critical is rho matter divided by rho curvature, basically. So it's if rho curvature is 0, then rho matter is the same as rho critical. But if there is a rho curvature, then... You see, rho curvature is not really density. Yeah.
So you can replace h by the substitution of, you can put the mass.
Okay, so let's discuss about that definition. I think this seems consistent with what I know. Now the other thing that people often define, and it's just for accounting purposes, because these are densities are dimensionful, but people are usually interested in working with dimensionless quantities. It's called omega. What they do is to define these omega variables. It's a ratio of densities divided by rho critical. And the sum of all omegas, including curvature, should be 1. So, for example, today we know omega matter, So all the ordinary matter that we know, all the non-relativistic matter that we know in the universe, omega matter is around 0.27. This is for today. Omega vacuum is around 0.7, well, I guess 0.73 or something like that. Actually, I can split up this omega matter to omega dark matter and omega baryons. So I told you in the first session that most of the matter in the universe is dark matter. So since this is around 0.24, omega baryon is about 0.04. Now, playing with numbers, so there are errors on this which I'm not writing down. Omega vacuum, or omega lambda, as people call it, this is most of the energy density of the universe, so it's around 0.7. Omega, let's see, what else is there? There are photons and neutrinos, let's say, so let's call them radiation. This is roughly 10 to the minus 4. And anything else you want to know the density of? I guess that's it. So these are the omegas. Now, these are not constant. They do change with time because these densities. So basically, those omegas are the relative fraction of density of the total density of the universe in each of these components. And since these are scaled differently by A, those omegas, those fractions, those relative ratios change different. Will be different in different times. So at early times, omega radiation is almost 1. Yes?
When you've defined rho, so rho k is the curvature.
Yes.
Density, and the other rho, does that include the vacuum and the dark matter and
everything, yes.
Everything else.
Everything else, that's okay. So yeah, I guess I call matter a bit different things in different places. But here, yeah, this is everything other than curvature. Okay? So good. So these are important definitions. Now, these A's, so let's just fill that table. So I guess we have the definition, and there it is here. So the equation that we are solving now is this, basically. H squared is equal to 8 pi g over 3, that rho, which includes everything. So A dot squared over A squared, this is essentially 8 pi g over 3, rho effective, let's call it, which is everything. And remember that this scale, if something dominates the density of the universe, this scale does 8 to the minus 3 times 1 plus w effective. So this is a first order differential equation. You can easily solve it up to an integration constant, which is a multiplicative integration constant. You can always. Now let's see, how does that work? You can always choose the origin of time arbitrarily and make the answer the power law. So the answers to this are generally t to some power, t minus a constant, t naught to some power. And you can always set that constant to be 0. That means that at t equal to 0, A was 0. So you had the Big Bang. So that power in this particular case is, so now this may not, you may not remember this then. Or maybe you will. So t to the 1/2, this is t to the 2/3, is today. When curvature dominates, this goes as t. And when vacuum dominates, this is e to the h naught t, exponential. I mean, this last one is easy to see. If this is constant, then a dot over a is constant, so it's exponential. Now, the other thing that's interesting to see is q, and that's it's basically you should take the second, remember the definition of Q is a double dot minus a double dot over a squared. A dot squared, sorry, yes.
So all the densities scale in the general sense.
That is true. That's a very good point. Yes, exactly. And that's because if A is a power law, then A dot over A always proportional to 1 over T squared. Right? Or A dot over A squared is always proportional to 1 over T squared. So the proportionality factor depends on this power. But as long as this is the power law, so as long as when the right-hand side is a power law, the solution to this is a power law, that means that the Hubble constant goes as 1 over T, basically, up to a constant. So for example, here, Hubble constant is 1 over 2T. Here, Hubble constant is 2 over 3T. So it's just up to a numerical factor. These are all 1 over T. So Hubble squared goes as 1 over T squared. All the densities go as 1 over T squared. So that's a very good observation. OK? Good. Perfect. So this was a definition of Q. And remember, this is what you can actually observe, say, from measuring distances, at least at low risk if you can observe this. And now, I cannot do this very quickly in my mind. What I can tell you is it's going to be, I think, minus 1 here, right? Because derivatives of the exponential are just exponential, basically. You just, when you take the derivatives of this, you get just extra h naughts. And when you divide these by these, all the h naughts cancel. You just get minus 1. For curvature, you get 0 for Q. And for all these other guys, you get something positive. And the interesting thing is that, so for ordinary gravity, you expect Q to be positive. Now, what you see is that Q seems to be more negative, today at least. And that's the indication of the vacuum domination. So right now, again, when you look at distance measurements from a standard candle or standard rulers, and measure Q, basically, which is the second order correction in the distance redshift relationship, gives you a negative Q. OK, so. But the other thing you can do is just calculate eta. I'm not going to do that here, I guess. So I promised I will. But you can just do it. You can plug these relationships, this integral. For example, eta, if a goes as t to the 1/2, eta goes as t to the 1/2 as well. If a goes as t to the 2/3, eta goes as t to the 1/3. This is the same as A. So in the radiation era, eta, the conformal time is proportional to A. Here, it's A squared. So I mean, these are all things that just playing with the power law. So you can all do it on your own. OK? So all very simple. Most of the, at least at the homogeneous cosmology is just playing with power laws to a good approximation. Now, of course, there are times where you have transition from one era to another. So basically, you can make a plot of these densities. Let me do that here. And this might be actually very useful. So let's look at all these densities as a function of, say, redshift. And today, redshift 0. And these are the ratios of different things. But then the thing that increases the fastest, so the radiation seems to be the smallest contribution, but this it increases the fastest. So if this is a log-log plot, this goes as a to the minus 4. The thing that's the biggest is the vacuum. But that increases, it doesn't change at all. Basically, the density of vacuum is constant as you go to early times. So even though it dominates right now, as you go to early times, it is completely subdominant. So this is radiation Now, here is where colors would be useful if I knew use them on time. So this is radiation. This is vacuum, or the cosmological constant. That's the other name for it. And then you have matter, or dark matter, or baryons. They actually behave more or less the same, at least at late times, until you go to very early universe. They are something between vacuum and radiation. So let's see if I can plot it well. Okay, good. So this is all the dust, basically, dark matter plus baryons. Everything that has non-relativistic pressure. Now you see that even though this is the ratio right now, at some point in the early universe, because even though matter there is much more of it right now than there is radiation, as you go to the early universe, at some point radiation dominates. That's what we saw. And from the ratio that you measure right now, 10 to the minus 4, you can say that around redshift of 1,000, or maybe it's really 3,000, there is an equality error, basically. You have rho matter equals rho radiation. Right? So after that, it's called matter error. Before that, it's called radiation error. And, well, I mean, you can actually call, so I guess these are three errors. There is a radiation error, there is a matter error, and right now, I mean, very, very short time ago, when redshift was around 0.5, vacuum dominates. So you can call it vacuum error, if you will. Or the inflationary, or the late time inflationary era. So this is roughly the timeline of how different types of, yes?
What's the quantity in the
time? Okay, so the reason that we plot Z instead of time is Z is what we actually measure observationally, as opposed to time, which, I mean, they are related to each other if you believe in Friedmann equation. But that's if you're just an observer and you don't believe in Einstein equation, for example, then what you measure is redshift. I think these are mostly historical reasons. Yeah, people are more used to this. The thing is that, I mean, but it's an important thing that the relationship between density and A, it doesn't depend on the application of Friedmann equation. It just, which I guess is here, it just relies on the continuity equation. And we often like to think that continuity equation is a little bit deeper than the Friedmann or the Einstein equations. Because, well, Einstein theory doesn't need to be the ultimate theory of gravity. There could be modifications to it in principle. But energy momentum conservation is just a statement of the equivalence principle, the weak equivalence principle, that all matter is symmetric. So these relationships between rho and A, these don't depend on Friedmann equation. So I don't need Friedmann equation to make this plot, basically. If assuming that I know this, at least the densities today. Yes?
Z can be up to 3,000.
Yeah, that's roughly 3,000. Yeah, that's basically, so the ratio of matter to radiation, so matter is about 0.1 roughly, omega radiation is 10 to the minus 4, but then the ratio increases, radiation to matter increases as A has to go to pi ratio. Yes?
So is this log Z you're plotting, or Z?
Yeah, well, it's a log plot.
Okay.
Yeah, so Z is 3,000, but it's a log plot. So this is my handmade log plot, so it's using.
I thought a redshift of like 8 was very far away.
It is very far away in terms of. Okay. But there is very little radiation today. So that's, you need to go really really early times for the radiation to dominate.
Yes.
So it's there is an interesting, I think, point in what you're saying, that if you look at the light point, so this is in the redshift space, and it seems that there is a large distance from, say, I don't know, 0.5 to 3,000 to high redshift. But it seems that in terms of physical distance, these are all actually squashed together, all the high redshifts are squashed together. So if you look at them, this is, I think, the exercise that we're going to do, either for the, I think, for the homework. If you look at R, the distance, the co-moving distance as a function of redshift, it does increase, so that's the Hubble law at low redshifts. But it actually just goes to a constant at very high redshifts. The co-moving distance goes to a constant at, as the z goes to, goes to infinity. This is true until very, very early times if you have inflation. If you don't have inflation, this just reaches asymptotes to a constant as z goes to infinity. But if you have inflation, it's just, it starts going up again. That's a whole different story. So that's right. So everything, so redshift of 8, in these terms, redshift of 8 and 3,000 aren't really that different because they have more or less the same distance. So let's say, I think redshift of 8 is probably halfway, more or less, I think redshift of 8 is halfway to redshift of 3,000. So this is how it looks like. I don't know what is it, logarithmic or what, but one final, some units. Okay. Let's see. So I told you, I think almost everything I needed to tell you about these different components. Now, one thing that's very puzzling is it seems no matter what you have, as you go to early times, you hit a singularity that A goes to zero. That A goes, when A goes to zero, it means density goes to infinity. And at some point, that means that you don't trust the theories anymore. Because basically, density is proportional to the curvature of a space-time. And if the curvature hits the Planckian curvature, then you don't really, you probably have to use the theory of quantum gravity, which you don't know yet. So that's something generic. That, of course, these are very simple cases, but you can, there are these so-called singularity theories that tell you that for all types of matter that you've considered that are not very exotic, you have singularity at some point in early time. Okay. So let's try to understand what's happening at early times a little bit better. Now, the reason we can do that is actually early times seem to be much, much simpler than late times. Now, they are not as simple because at some point you hit the Planck era that you don't understand. And even before you hit the Planck era, there are very high energies where you don't, may not understand the physics. For example, a standard model of particle physics that you're learning about from Michael, you understand it and you believe it to be a right theory of the universe up to energies of TeV. So beyond that, you don't really understand the physics. So in that sense, it's a very ambiguous era as you go to very early universe, anything above, any temperature above a tera electron volt. But it is simple in a sense that universe seems to be very homogeneous, and that we know from the cosmic microwave background. It seems to be very isotropic. So that's why you could actually use simple tools of equilibrium and statistical mechanics to describe the processes in the early universe. And that has been actually the origin of the most successful predictions in cosmology, the calculations, all the predictions that have been done for the early universe physics. So the way that things work there are, so let's do, so if you have something that's in thermal equilibrium, so you could either have fermions, or you could have bosons. So what are the distribution, phase space densities of these? I mean, that you must have studied, right? So if you have you're in thermal equilibrium, how does the phase space distribution velocity position look like for fermions? You must have heard of this somewhere. Okay, I'm gonna write it for you. So this is the so-called Fermi Dirac distribution. You've all seen this, right? Okay, good. So the other one then is what? Yeah, okay, it's minus one, exactly. So I suppose the Einstein distribution. Now, who can tell me what is the role of this mu here? So mu is a so-called chemical potential. Now, why do you need mu there? Yeah. So that's true. So because it costs energy to add, that's one way to think about it. Another way to think about it is that if you put something in thermal equilibrium with a heat bath, but the number of particles is fixed, you cannot create or annihilate particles through this interaction with the heat bath, then you need to add a Lagrange multiplier essentially to keep the number of particles constant. And this mu plays the role of that Lagrange multiplier. If the number of particles is not fixed, if you could create or annihilate particles freely, then mu is zero. You don't need a mu there. For example, for photons in black body distribution of a black body spectrum of photons, if it's in thermal equilibrium with a black body, which can produce or destroy photons, so photons can be absorbed and emitted, then mu is zero. But if all your processes conserve the number of particles, then you need to add mu to keep the number of particles constant. So that's something that's important and a bit also mysterious, that we seem to think that in early universe at very, very high temperatures, you can annihilate and create everything. So mu is essentially zero for everything in the early universe. Now, this is true unless there are certain conserved charges, certain things that you cannot change in the early universe. For example, the baryon number seem to be conserved, at least today, at least for all the interactions that we know. But then if you think a baryon number was not a conserved because of interactions that we don't know in the early universe, then there is a bit of a dilemma, basically, that how you get from mu equal to zero in early universe to mu not equal to zero right now. You know, basically, so that's something that we don't really understand very well, for example, for baryons. And I'm not going to talk much about either. But so I just tell you that all I want to tell you is that if you have any reason to believe something is conserved, for example, a baryon number is conserved, then mu is not zero for it. But if that there is no conserved number, then mu should be zero. Now, that if you start with this assumption of mu equal to zero, then everything is very simple. Then you don't have this. And the temperature tells you everything, basically. Right? So the temperature tells you the energy density, for example. So energy density, which is what you need to plug in here, is integral T3P over 2 pi cubed f of x and p. And it turns out that if mu is equal to 0, in both these cases, this is going to be, I want to make sure I've got the right factors here. So this is going to be proportional, let's say. This is going to be equal to some constant times GB, which is the number of bosons you have. Well, let's put it here. Times their temperature to the fourth plus 7/8 times the same constant, AB, the number of fermions that you have, temperature of fermion to the fourth. Okay? And you can see this just from dimension analysis that. Okay, so now the other thing I want to say that this is for relativistic particles, assuming that energy or temperature is much bigger than the mass. If you assume temperature is much bigger, yes?
How is x related?
Oh, there is no x, because universe is homogeneous.
Okay.
So this is the phase space density per species. So every species has this density, basically the number of particles within a phase space volume is f of x and p, d3x, d3p, right? If you take a phase space volume, this is that. Now, the other interesting thing to notice is that this is actually a conserved quantity in an expanding universe. So even though you would think that the momentum redshift in the early universe, that's basically the photon, the momentum of a photon as the universe expands goes down. This quantity doesn't. This quantity is a constant. And this is something very deep that maybe you can think about it and try to prove it. This phase space volume is something that seems to be a Lorentz invariant quantity. Yes?
Are we taking
Barry
number to be conserved or not?
We do take Barry number to be conserved. But then we cannot, we don't set mu equal to 0 for variance.
Okay.
So at late time for variance, mu cannot be 0.
But at early time, because we're setting mu to be 0.
Yeah.
So are we taking mu to be conserved?
Yeah, so at early times, we ignore mu, basically.
Okay. And why do fermions and baryons have different temperatures?
They, okay, are so they can or they don't have to have different values.
This is just a general expression.
Yeah, this is a general expression. And the reason I put a 7x here, essentially, so you can take both these integrals, but because of this certain sign, the coefficients in front of them are slightly different. Turns out the coefficient in front of this is 7/8, the coefficient in front of this. And the temperatures are the same if they are all in thermal equilibrium. If your bosons and fermions interact fast enough so that they have the same temperature. However, as you go at later times in the universe, you can reach points, or so-called freeze-out points, where some of the species don't interact with other species very much. Basically, what you find is, so let me write this now. So it's the so-called, so there's thermal equilibrium versus freeze-out. So if you have the number of particles times interaction cross-section times velocity, if this is larger than the Hubble rate, then you are in thermal equilibrium. Let's say, I mean, in this particular case, your bosons and fermions are in thermal equilibrium. But if it is less than Hubble rate, then these don't need to be the same. And it turns out there are particles that interact weakly with other, for example, neutrinos or dark matter particles, if we have weak interaction, and that has to do with, that's going to be the problem that we're solving this afternoon. they have very big interaction. And it turns out that, and you can actually see, assuming that, say, if sigma b is constant, n usually drops as 1 over a cube. But h, remember, h is, so h is the square root of rho. So in the early universe, in the radiation era, this is a to the minus 2. So this guy drops faster than this guy. So at early times, everything is in thermal equilibrium. Because interaction densities are very high, interaction rates are very fast. But at late times, the interaction rates become less than a Hubble time. So essentially, it takes forever for a particle to meet another particle. Yes?
So how do we interpret, now that we're talking about the Hubble constant as a rate, it's the rate of what? The rate of?
So,
I mean, this is an interaction rate, or like a reaction rate, right? And
yes. That's right. So the Hubble constant, let's see, so what is the best way to see this? Now, I mean, there is a, so the problem that you're solving this afternoon, that you can, you're actually solving the equation. So what you're doing, so the equation, the interaction equations in an expanding universe are not the same as interaction universe in a static or in a flat space time. There are factors of a cubed that appear. So basically what happens is, so let me write it down here. So say the number of fermions, let's say. But the equation that you are solving, something that looks like this, roughly, not exactly. N fermion, N boson, A cubed times sigma B. Now, if A was constant, this would be just the standard interaction equation. So basically, the number of fermions change every time. So this is basically the rate of seeing bosons. So a random fermion which is moving in empty space, the rate of meeting a boson is the number density of bosons times sigma v. So this is the standard thing. Now, in an expanding universe, all these particles are moving away from each other. So the way to do it properly is to put an A cubed here. And that's, you can prove it in different way, but I think you can discuss this in tutorial. And what happens is that you have this extra term here. You have NF dot plus 3H NF, which is roughly equal to NF times this guy. And A cubed cancel. So the term that's, essentially, what happens is when this term takes over this term, then this interaction becomes negligible. So, yeah.
So, but it just seems that if we have an interaction rate, that rate, when it's greater than some other rate, we're not frozen out, and when it's less than some other rate, so we find out.
Yeah.
But
okay, so let's, okay, here's a good way of seeing it. So let's say you have a fermion that once is, if it meets a boson, it annihilates, goes to something else. So the number of bosons that it's going to meet is going to be something like this, right? So you have a random fermion going along in its way. There are bosons with given cross sections on the way. This is like a mean, that's right. So the number of interactions is proportional to this. Now, the thing is that this number density is dropping with time. So this goes as 1 over a cubed. So the thing is that this integral is actually finite. It's not infinite. So if you had a flat universe where n was constant, so if you had a non-expanding flat universe, n was constant, this would go to infinity. So eventually, you're going to see the fermion is going to see the boson. But this is finite now in an expanding universe. So after a certain time, you don't interact, essentially, anymore. So this is the key quantity then. This is the so-called, I think, optical depth or something like this, which is dimensionless and tells you how many interactions you have. And it turns out that after a certain time, you have less than one interaction per Hubble time. So that's, that, and since this integral is finite, you essentially have less than one interaction until infinity. So this is exactly what we would call freeze out. When this so-called optical depth, people call it tau, becomes less than one. Of course, then the question is, what are the boundaries of the integral? So you could either take it from some time to infinity. So that's probably a more sensible way of doing it, because if you go all the way to zero, this integral diverges, becomes infinite. But if you go from some time to infinity, this is always finite. And so when tau basically becomes comparable to 1, that's the so-called freeze-out, when you go from one case to another. Now, after that, if something happens in one of the sectors and changes its temperature, the other sector doesn't need to find out about it. OK. Sorry, this is not right. Yeah. OK. So let's see. I mean, the example of that is, and I'm not going to do the calculation here for you, but it's a standard calculation you can look up in any of the cosmology books out there, is when, so where should I erase now? Let's erase these ones. Where electrons and positrons annihilate. So if you go, so you know, mass of electron is, you should know this. What is the mass of electron?
0.519.
Okay, so I'm going to go with the, okay, so I guess to make everybody equally unhappy, I'm going to use this unit. So now what does it mean? It means that at early universe, when the temperature is larger than this, then you can produce electrons and positrons arbitrarily, because photons, basically, when they can collide with each other, and if they have enough energy, they can produce real electrons and positrons. So at early universe, you could actually use the same formula to estimate how many electrons and positrons, or what is the density of electrons or positrons. That goes as temperature to the fourth. Now, when the temperature drops below this, one thing that happens is, essentially, there isn't enough energy to produce electrons and positrons. So photons have too little energy when they collide with each other. They cannot produce electrons and positrons. But if electrons and positrons collide with each other, they annihilate and go to photons. So essentially what happens at that point is that the density of electrons and positrons drops exponentially. And that you can actually see from this equation. F is for fermions, it's E divided by T plus 1. And the minimum energy for electrons at their mass, so this is larger than, well, I guess at low temperatures, this is roughly 1 over E to the M divided by T plus 1. Now, when temperature drops below the mass, this term is much bigger than 1, so you can ignore this. So this is roughly e to the minus m divided by t. So the number of electrons and positrons, this is the phase space density, but number density is proportional to this. It's going to drop exponentially when the temperature becomes. So it's going to drop very, very fast. This means that all the electrons and positrons annihilate and become photons, right? So one. Now, this is the point where neutrinos, for example, are already decoupled. So neutrinos decouple from the photons. So they are very weakly interacting with photons. So they decouple from the photons at early times. I don't remember, actually, the temperature. I should have looked it up. I believe it's somewhere around the GeV. Now, it's kind of embarrassing because this is being recorded, so I should know this. But let's say it's GEV within two orders of magnitude. Okay, so I think I'm safe enough. So that means that at this time, neutrinos don't find out about the fact that electrons and positrons annihilate into photons. So the sector that has, so the electrons, positrons, photons, they are in thermal equilibrium, and neutrinos, and possibly dark matter maybe, is these sectors don't talk to each other. So dark matter, of course, we don't know much about, so can't tell much about it. But these two don't talk it to each other. So what happens when electrons and positrons annihilate to photons is that the photon temperature goes up because you produce more photons. Neutrinos don't find out about it. So the temperature of neutrinos doesn't change. So this is, now if you follow through this calculation, and we're not going to have time to do this, but this is straightforward, you find that, for example, the temperature of photons divided by temperature of neutrinos predicted to be 11⁴ to the power of 1/3. And this is basically the fact that you heat up the photons, so the temperature goes up when electron positrons annihilate. The neutrinos don't care about it, so they maintain their temperature. Now, all of these temperatures, if something like this doesn't happen, all of these temperatures are dropping like 1 over A. And remember, this is just the redshift, a standard redshift formula. Temperature is like frequency drops like 1 over A. But the ratio of temperatures, since all of them are dropping like 1 over A, the ratio doesn't change unless something like this happens, unless essentially the number of a species effectively changes. So in this case, electrons and positrons become relativistic. They completely disappear and drop out. And then there's a calculation that you should do, and you can show that essentially entropy remains conserved, although the number of particles changes. So during that period, the ratio of temperature changes, but after and before that, the ratio of temperatures remains constant. So basically, they just change adiabatically like this. So let's see. So what else do I need to tell you about the early universe? The thing that I need to tell you last, and I think I need to wrap up now, it has to do with the microwave background. Now, there is a point where electrons also decouple from photons. Now, the thing that's surprising is not all electrons and positrons go away. There is a little bit of them that is left. And that's what we have today. Now, it turns out that little bit is very small, but it's still non-negligible. This much, around 10 to the minus 10 of electrons and positrons is left. And that has to do, and that's the fact that the mystery that I told you, that mu is not exactly equal to 0. Because if mu was exactly 0, you had this exponential that told you that everything is exponentially negligible. Now, it turns out the mu is not exactly 0, and that's why we exist right now. So that's why, fortunately enough, that mu wasn't exactly 0. It was tiny. There were about 10 to the minus 10 offset between electrons and positrons. So that when they all annihilated, there is this much left. And that's what led to our existence. So there's the lepton number and the baryon number. So they are both conserved.
So wait, is that the density of electrons and positrons?
No, this is just electrons. The positrons, so there's an offset between the density of electrons and positrons. And that's conserved. So, I mean, so electrons and positrons can annihilate and give photons, right? But the difference between the number, or let's say capital N E minus capital N E plus, this is conserved. This is the lepton number. Although, one part of the lepton number, there are neutrinos, but they are decoupled, basically. So this part is conserved because they can annihilate and go. But the difference is conserved. And it turns out that this is this divided by number of photons. This is 10 to the minus 10. OK. So I think this is a good part, good time to stop. Tomorrow, I'm going to tell you about the cosmic microwave background and just generally cosmological observations. So, any more questions? OK, thank you.